Hello and welcome to It Was Mooney, your source for commentary on all things movie and pop culture related. I'm your host, Cosi, and I'm joined always by
Bonnie B.
And today's episode was brought to you by SpaghettiOs. Not really, they're terrible. I actually hated those things, so no.
Anyways, on this week's episode, we take a minute to introduce ourselves and why we're making this podcast. Then we go right into the Oscars show for 2024, the winners and losers, snubs and popular events, and we discuss our thoughts on the overall show, its place in the current media landscape, and what things can be improved from here.
All right, sounds good. But Juan, I guess real quick, let's just for our listeners out there, like, what made us, or what made you even want to start this?
You know, basically, the concept came down to the fact, you know, we watch a lot of movies.
Yes, we
watch a lot of entertainment. Literally, we have a group chat just for setting up movie pretty much weekly.
Shout out AMC gang.
Yeah, AMC gang. Basically, every week going to the movies. And then, you know, we'll easily spend 30, 40 minutes after the movie just standing right outside in the middle of the theater.
In the lobby, yelling out spoilers as people are coming out of the movie theaters.
Yeah, man. Very shamelessly. But, you know, we just go into it. We have these great discussions. We tie the movie into the bigger themes, to our lives, to obviously interesting action scenes, awesome moments. You know, we have a lot of fun doing so, and we thought, hey, let's bring that to a wider audience.
Yeah, like, we really want to have you, the listener, be there in our discussions, whether it be outside of AMC or inside of our homes right now. So we wanted to make you guys a part of that and just bring you guys into our discussion and our interesting opinions. So speaking of which, let's just go into it because, you know, the Oscars 2024, it's a big deal, huh?
Yeah, very big deal. Well, honestly, depends on who you ask these days.
Definitely. Well, we will get into that a little bit later. But yeah, just real quick, I just want to just run through just the big winners of tonight. So first, best animated feature film went to The Boy and the Heron. Shout out to Hayao Miyazaki. Super sad for the Spider-Verse team. Across the Spider-Verse lost out. I think it's one of my favorite movies of last year.
That might have been straight up my favorite movie of last year. I thought that was a gimme for the Oscar. I think Into the Spider-Verse did win the...
Yes, it did win. It won Best Animated Feature. I was hoping it would pull a Beauty and the Beast 1991 where it could get nominated for Best Overall Picture, but I was so happy that the first Spider-Verse got that. But yeah, definitely rooting for the whole team that worked on that. But you know, you can never really count out Hayao Miyazaki because he just stays winning. So
interesting to note as well that, you know, there was a Pixar original picture in the running, and it frankly, frankly, wasn't even relevant.
Yeah.
You know, we've gotten to the point where a Pixar movie. It used to be a Pixar movie, pretty much instantly won.
Was the best animated film.
It's not like it was controversial. Pixar, pretty much every time they came out with a movie, was the best animated movie of the year. Yeah. Wasn't a stretch to call it just the Pixar award at a certain point.
Right.
And nowadays, you know, Elemental was still pretty good, but...
I enjoyed Elemental.
It was a nice touching story about an immigrant family. But, you know, it doesn't live up to anywhere near their best movies. And... I don't think, as much fun as I had with it, I don't think you could consider it a serious contender for Animated Picture of the Year, which, again, you know, and you consider some of their past work, that definitely is a shock. But, you know, we'll have to discuss that later.
But again, The Boy and the Heron, personally for me, it wasn't one of Miyazaki's best, but definitely in his pantheon of works that he's done, it's still a fantastic film. I just don't think it was his best work, but again, still... All the credit goes to Hayao Miyazaki and his team on that. Next up, for best visual effects, I think the best visual effects, one of the best visual effects you saw last year was in The Creator, which was up for it, but the one that won was Godzilla Minus One, which I was so very, very happy for. One of my favorite movies of last year, one of the best of last year that I saw. So what do you think about that, Juan?
Well, you know, anytime you have a gigantic T-Rex lizard on screen and you pull it off convincingly, that's definitely going to get heavy consideration for visual effects. So definitely can't complain about that.
Yeah, and I love the team that went up to, they all went up to go receive the award. They each had their own little Godzilla toy in their hand along with their Oscar. So it felt really cool that it felt like a team of just huge Godzilla fans that finally got, you know, the recognition for their hard work on such, you know, it's a property that's like 60 years old. So it's amazing that's never, first time it's winning for visual effects. So it's a great thing. So up next, rapid fire here. So best adapted screenplay. It was a tough race. So American Fiction won. Seriously, it beat out the works of Barbie, Oppenheimer, Poor Things, and Zone of Interest. So what do you think about the winner, American Interest?
Honestly, American Fiction, sorry. I don't have strong opinions. It's a good movie. I do find it funny that somehow that was one of the few awards Barbie was even nominated for. Like one of the more serious awards, so to speak. No best director for Greta Gerwig. No best actress for Margot Robbie. They get nominated for best picture.
And best supporting for, I think
for Ryan Gosling. They got a couple things. But definitely mostly got shut out other than, well, one of the next award we were going to discuss, best original song.
Yeah.
Somehow a song from the Barbie movie won and it's not I'm Just Ken. Would you
go into that a little bit?
Would you have ever really predicted that coming out of that movie?
Yeah, I thought it was gonna be Peaches from the Super Mario Brothers movie. Quite frankly, I thought we'd see that.
That would have been a fun one.
But going into that, best original song did go to Billie Eilish for "What Was I Made For," which she performed at the ceremony. So
it's a lovely song, but it feels like like the kind of Oscars kind of sheen they look for. I mean, I'm Just Ken was the standout song of that movie.
And I think they wanted to give it its due by having Ryan come out and perform it with Simu Liu, with Kings of Benadir and Nikuti Gatwa, like the other Kens. But I think they got its moment, but I think I can see why Billie's song won.
It's just this kind of Oscar type of choice that they make because they want to have, I don't know, a certain type of genteel movie taste.
I think
most people who came out of that movie would say I'm Just Ken was the defining song.
It was definitely the one that we were all humming at the end. All right, so again, going into this rapid fire some more, we're going to it gets kind of dicey here. Best actress in a supporting role. So the nominees were Emily Blunt in Oppenheimer, Danielle Brooks in The Color Purple, America Ferrera in Barbie, and Jodie Foster in Nyad, and Devine Jo Randolph in The Holdovers, with Devine Jo Randolph winning, and this is her first ever Oscar. So Devine was amazing in The Holdovers. The Holdovers was a movie not a lot of people saw last year. It's Paul Giamatti. He plays this really cranky teacher, and he has to stay with these students and be like their surrogate father during, you know, a really, really bad snowstorm in the winter. And Devine Jo Randolph, she plays a person in the school that kind of helps him. And I think her performance in it was just, it's one of those where Paul Giamatti is always, you know, is chewing the scenery. But Devine, her performance was just so subdued, just so like strong and just stoic and just in a way that really played off of, you know, the bravado that is Paul Giamatti. And I was just so happy for Devine. So what did you think about the winners here?
Unfortunately, I missed out on the movie, but great thoughts on that end. You know, obviously Paul Giamatti got nominated as well, so some strong acting performances.
Yeah, but what do you think about the other actresses though? Emily Blunt and Oppenheimer.
Emily Blunt, I thought
amazing job.
Stole the show a little bit. Frankly, more of a meaty role than most women get in Nolan movies.
Yeah, I would say that.
Still gets a little... Her acting was tremendous. Her actual purpose in the movie gets a little murky, I feel like, sometimes. Same with
Florence Pugh.
Florence Pugh.
But they both... I think they both serve their purpose for their roles in Oppenheimer's life and their roles in the story, I think. I think sometimes, you know, people can have like a fleeting role or like a bit part, but if it serves a story, which in my opinion, I think they both did serve them. I think that's all that matters. And they did such a great job.
Yeah, no, there were some very strong performances. Emily Blunt's speech at the end in particular,
oh, my goodness,
in the trial room was very effective. She's a very strong actress.
And speaking of which, who was also in the trial room, the winner of the best supporting actor role, Iron Man himself, Robert Downey Jr., his first ever Oscar win. Like, just think about that. And Robert Downey Jr.'s illustrious career, I know everybody, he's Iron Man, but he's been in tons of other stuff from Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. He played Charlie Chaplin at one point. He was an 80s movie heartthrob kid.
He was Sherlock.
And like, obviously, like, a lot, he had his shortcomings, his ups and downs, but like, he kind of almost like Tony Stark, like, rose out of that cave he was in to like come and like, now he's at the top of the acting world right now. So like, what do you think about Robert Downey Jr. finally getting to that?
Tremendous performance in the movie.
Yes,
indeed. My personal pick, honestly, I probably would have picked Ryan Gosling.
Him also, Mark Ruffalo in Poor Things was, I don't even though you didn't see it, but Mark Ruffalo in Poor Things was so damn funny and so good and so just off kilter. I don't know. I would have loved it if he got it too.
One person that I'm surprised didn't get more, I guess, love going into the award season was Robert De Niro.
Oh, yeah.
Not to take away from Robert Downey Jr.'s performance, but, I mean, Robert De Niro owned Killers of the Flower Moon. Even when he was not on screen.
His presence was felt, even when,
you know, the whole movie revolves around him.
Mm-hmm.
He makes such effective use of the small moments. We've seen Robert De Niro play a villain before and play an angry man, but this was different. This wasn't some angry, lonely, toxic person. This was King of the South, genteel, you know, royalty.
Yeah.
Literally, you know,
he owns the ground you're walking on. Yeah. So like,
and people were happy to let him own it.
Yeah,
and he portrayed that in such a way that you both see why the town liked them so much and why people were so drawn to him. But you also instantly, from the first scene he's in, you know he's the bad guy.
Yeah.
You know he's behind it all. He has that menace, that calculating menace behind the happy smile. It doesn't contradict each other. The happy smile helps to sell the menace. It's just truly a tremendous performance.
Yeah.
You know, as much as I liked Ryan Gosling's performance, Robert De Niro's is the kind of performance the Oscars tend to reward.
Yeah.
The kind of performance we tend to talk about.
Like,
I do wonder if a little bit, again, as great as Robert Downey Jr.'s performance was, I do wonder if some of it was simply, you know, Robert De Niro has won a couple. He's already... We don't have to worry if he's going to get one later on because he's already won several. He's already known as one of the greatest actors of this and any generation.
Right.
And will continue to be known for the years and decades to come. So it felt like, okay, if we're going to be, if they're both going to be mostly even, let's give it to the newbie who deserves this, who we all want to give love to, who we gave absolutely no credibility for Iron Man, even though some of those roles, particularly in Endgame, probably deserved at least a nomination.
I'd say so, yeah. So it really did feel like a lifetime achievement, but I think I'll still push back and say his performance in Oppenheimer was spectacular. And
it was tremendous.
It was well-deserved.
It was tremendous. The movie did not revolve around him, but the way it kind of did around Ryan Gosling and Robert De Niro, but he was incredibly effective and stole the show in every scene he was in. So.
Right.
I can't disagree with that opinion too hard.
Oh yeah, and then before we move on, shout out to Sterling K. Brown in American Fiction. He's always excellent, one of my favorite actors out there. So shout out to him for even getting nominated because it's really hard to get nominated. Now we're getting into the big ones now. So best actress. So Emma Stone won for Poor Things, and look, I was rooting for Lily Gladstone, Killers of the Flower Moon. She is the beating heart of a movie that I think is, the movie made me mad to watch, just seeing horrible people just do horrible things, but she really was the heart, the face of the movie, and she provided such the emotional anchor that everything she's in, even though she's not in it for a lot of the movie, you would think she's in it, but she's not in it for a lot of it, but again, she uses her screen time so well, and I was rooting for her, but my goodness, you gotta watch Poor Things, but Emma Stone, she's phenomenal. Like, again, like, I think everyone's known about Emma, you know, La La Land, but, like...
Well, she's an Academy Award winner.
She's an, but coming in, like, she hit... You know how, like in sports, like, an athlete can just hit another gear? Like, all right, a running back's running, okay, but he knows to clock it in to get the end zone. Emma Stone just hit another gear, and what Yorgos Lanthimos, he's the director of Poor Things. He also directed The Favorite. What he does is he brings this out of all his performers. Emma Stone was in The Favorite prior to this with him, and it's the same thing, but you can see her evolution, because it's 6 years later in Poor Things, and she's playing a woman who was a Frankenstein monster, basically, like, and she's brought back to life, and she's experiencing life from birth all the way up to maturity, and, like, she's having to go to amazing depths, and, you know, I just think she did more. There was more for her to do for in Emma Stone, but I think Lily Gladstone did more with what she had, if that makes sense.
Okay, so Lily Gladstone was unbelievably great in Killers of the Flower Moon, and that's the kind of performance that deserves to be rewarded pretty much every year.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously there's the sentimental aspect of it would have been the first Native woman to win an Oscar, and of course it adds a little bit of historical pathos to the decision.
Of course.
It gave a little bit more momentum for her. You almost wanted her to win just to complete kind of that journey, just to show that the Oscars have been listening and are rewarding, you know, a more diverse set of winners and not just the same cookie cutter white folk movies every year.
And also diverse, but also supremely talented. Because it's more than just being diverse. I love that. Yes, she's indigenous, but Lily Gladstone is a damn good actress who hasn't been getting a lot of traction. But this is like the biggest traction she's gotten. So I love that. You're right. Just to piggyback off of your point, though.
No, and she deserves it. Sometimes, you know, this diversity push comes, you know, it makes people feel that you're picking somebody based on their race. Or based on the narrative instead of based on who's most deserving. And just to be clear, Lily Gladstone was extremely deserving. The fact that she was a Native woman was a bonus consideration, not the reason she should have been picked.
But here's the unfortunate thing about the Oscars. You can have an incredible performance, but you just have to hope that somebody else doesn't have the performance of their lifetime in the same year that you do. And that's the unfortunate but reality of the Oscars sometimes. That's the
takeaway, that Emma Stone gave a once-in-a-lifetime performance from
in the same year that Lily did, too.
From the description everyone was giving. Lily Gladstone gave an amazing performance. I don't know if I'd call it once-in-a-lifetime.
I understand that.
Just top-tier. Again, the kind of performance that you'd be happy to see win an Oscar. You know, the scenes where she's lying in bed, ill.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, just the whole movie, the way she loses her family and then the quiet strength she maintains.
It's the acting without speaking for me. It's the acting she can convey and just looks. And just fantastic.
The subtle changes in her facial expression that hide these devastating changes in emotions that you know are lurking behind, but that the character sells you on, you know, she's tough. She's a hard woman. She's a Native woman. She's not going to go openly cry and go into hysterics.
Super measured, super intelligent, understands what's happening. But she just
riveting movie, riveting performance.
Yeah, but no, just shout out to all of the of Our Lady and the nominees. But you know, great job, Emma and Lily. We'll see her again. We'll see her, Lily Gladstone, in a movie. She's not going anywhere, and she's here to stay. And I love that. Next up, then, Best Actor. It went to. No, Cillian Murphy as J. Robert Oppenheimer himself. What could I say? What else could I say about
really
this?
There's really not too much to argue with.
This was July, but as I was watching, I was like, yo, this dude just might win this.
Who were the other nominees?
So he beat out Bradley Cooper in The Maestro, which I haven't seen yet. Coleman Domingo, an incredible actor who I love, in Rustin, Paul Giamatti in The Holdovers, and Jeffrey Wright in American Fiction. I have not seen The Maestro or Rustin, but I can attest to both Jeffrey Wright and Paul Giamatti's performances. Paul Giamatti, in particular, I thought had a dark horse chance of like at least challenging Cillian Murphy, but My goodness. Cillian Murphy just...
Paul Giamatti just automatically has a chance just by showing up.
You know? I've loved Paul Giamatti.
He just does not make bad movies.
Remember when Paul Giamatti was that blue guy in Big Fat Liar?
I was just thinking of that. That's hilarious. You know, with Amanda Bynes.
Yeah, Amanda Bynes and friend Malcolm in the Middle himself, Frankie Muniz. Yeah,
like, I was just thinking of that. He was still a quality villain.
He was going for it even in a kids movie. Like it was amazing. I love that. So, that Best Actor race was tough because of those top three being, Giamatti, Murphy, and Wright.
But it's crazy, following Cillian Murphy's career. You remember him in Red Eye?
Loved him in Red Eye with Rachel McAdams. He played that creeper guy.
I mean, not just that movie, like, for a big early part of his career, was basically the creepy, skinny white dude who shows up in the movie. He was Scarecrow in Batman.
The same year as Red Eye, he was Scarecrow. Like,
like, his role was that kind of eerie dude who's kind of good looking, but also is probably a serial killer.
But Peaky Blinders, like, blew everything up.
Peaky Blinders, really changed my opinion of him? Quiet Place Part 2.
Oh, man, it's Emmett.
Not that he was particularly incredible in it. He was just some regular ass neighbor, like just a redneck type dude. Mm-hmm. But that was what was incredible, that he went from this very posh looking, skinny, creepy dude, looks like he came straight out of, a One Direction casting, but like on the creepy side. and then all of a sudden he's playing like some hillbilly redneck dude in Quiet Place Part 2.
More so, he's like resourceful. Like, he reminded me a lot of Joe from Last of Us. Like, not Joe. Reminded me of Joel from Last of Us.
Tommy. No, it's that kind of character, that kind of resourceful, woodsy, rural character.
Do it yourself,
like, I would not have expected Cillian Murphy to be able to play that role after watching his early career.
Yeah,
and not to say that that's what he does in Oppenheimer. But I think that's what showed me that his range was much greater than you'd think from his earlier movie. Not that he was bad in his earlier movies, but you thought he was typecast. You thought he was just going to keep playing the creepy, weird guy that was always the villain at some point and always creeping people out. And then, no, he actually nowadays is coming full circle and, he's in a Nolan movie.
He's a leading man.
But
he's always been a leading man, but like
he's a key man, but now he is the leading man, the leading good man, and he plays a scientist, someone committed to being good, someone who's not creepy at all.
there's a lot of the one thing I got from is again because his performance is really measured as well, but again his performance had conveyed to me the. There's duality within Robert Oppenheimer. Yes, here's a man whose whole life was about, pushing the limits of science and just discovery, but he's now realizing that his gift is now becoming a curse to the world because now his research is what was a catalyst for what would become the atomic bomb. And then he sees that his work is now, harming thousands of people and could harm potentially more. And, like, just seeing that he's uneasy. The best part is when... he did his speech and everyone's like, remember everyone's cheering and then all the sound comes out and you're just there with him. No one was able to convey how we were in there with Oppenheimer. We were in there in his head almost. And Cillian Murphy was able to really convey that to the viewer. And I just loved it. And just kudos to him and his career. Like, seriously, the guy has been in so many movies. 28 Days Later, that was him.
That was
one of the first things he was in.
All this is a nice segue into the final two big awards.
We're at the end now. The final award, which is Best Picture.
Best Director and Best Picture.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yes.
Both won by Oppenheimer.
Christopher Nolan.
Christopher Nolan winning his first Oscar. I don't know if this is my favorite.
That's his first Oscar.
Yeah, I don't know if this is my favorite Christopher Nolan movie. But I mean, it's probably his best made.
It's the culmination of Christopher Nolan's work. You can see glimpses of where throughout his career where he's picked up things and now he's like, all right, now I'm Christopher Nolan and you're going to see just what I can do. And he put all of his skills, everything on display in Oppenheimer. And I think it was...
You know, incredible. I think it helped him too that this is the kind of movie that the Oscars love to reward, right?
Yeah.
We've seen biopics of World War II famous white dudes. I mean, Oscars.
We used to get slave movies. Slave movies got in
20 slave Oscars love those too. Oscars love those too.
They love Black Struggle.
We didn't have those slave movies this year, so. We know we're going back to the World War II.
Oh, they didn't nominate Will Smith in Emancipation, no? No? Okay.
Yeah, so basically, I think it hit the sweet spot of it was the kind of movie the Oscars like to give rewards to, but it was also an incredible movie, an incredible feat by him. I had more fun with Inception and Dark Knight, even maybe Tenet, but this was top-tier filmmaking.
Yeah.
The scenes where he's building Oppenheimer's life, where you kind of see the inside of his mind, you see the almost the stars revolving.
Like to the explosion works. Yeah.
The explosion. Okay, yeah, it wasn't a nuclear explosion. But okay, the anticipation, the buildup. I mean, I felt like I couldn't breathe. I felt like once that went off, I hadn't been breathing for several minutes during the movie. Yeah. It just the buildup to that was awe-inspiring. Usually gets thrown around too much, but it really was left you feeling odd. The sound, the performances, the actual gravity of what you knew was happening. Truly, he brought that to scale in a way that was just incredible to watch. Much love to him. He's pretty much the only director in Hollywood where people will show up to make just about anything he makes.
Is it Nolan? Okay, we're there.
He could literally come up tomorrow and say he's making a live-action Rugrats movie, and that would make over $1 billion.
Yeah, like, we'll be there. We would and look, and he's the kind of, but he's also the kind of director that, I know I said this last time when we were talking about Dune Part 2, but this, he makes movies that make me love being a movie fan. Like, he makes movies that really, because Christopher Nolan, he's a movie fan like us. He loves film. He loves how it makes you feel. He loves the transformative nature of film. He loves what film can do. And he tries to put that into everything that he makes. Whether or not you like it or not, you still get that with a Nolan film. That's what you get to sit down. It reminds you of just what, you know, we're capable of doing in film. And, you know, all kudos to him for winning the Best Picture. He beat out stuff like Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Past Lives, which was amazing. You should watch Barbie, I love Barbie. I think having those two be kind of, those two will forever be connected, Barbie and Oppenheimer, Barbenheimer is what I call it. They'll be forever connected because proving, Hollywood kind of prove, and we'll get into this, but kind of prove that, you know, having counter programming can work. Two gigantically different fan bases and groups, but still they're both able to make almost $2 billion collectively. So I love that Oppenheimer was both a very popular film, but also a very well-made film by a, you know, auteur director of our time. So
well-deserving Best Picture. My favorite movie was probably either Spider-Verse or maybe even Barbie. But, you know, it's hard to argue against what Oppenheimer achieved and the quality of the film.
If I were giving out a Best Picture, I think it would go to Godzilla Minus One. Quite frankly, Godzilla Minus One was such it's the perfect monster movie. But I think one of the best movies made of last year. But yeah, just I enjoyed it. Just real quick, so those are the winners. But there's also other stuff that happened during it. Like, so John Cena thought we couldn't see him, but we can definitely see a big ass just coming out with just, what was that, like a,
cardboard. I think that was like the card where he has the nominees in.
Look, if I look like John Cena, I'd do that, so I all power to him.
John Cena can get away with showing up naked to the Oscars and getting people excited.
Yeah.
If me and Kosi showed up to the Oscars that way, we'd get the police called.
We'd be slapped and then escorted out in that order.
It would not be a pretty sight.
Dude, what'd you think of Al Pacino's audition for Scarface 2?
Listen, man. I mean, what the dude's, 80-something years old?
He's ancient.
He does not care. You know what I mean? Like,
he was having fun. I think the internet could be ruthless. They're coming from a man.
Once you hit that age, you have to accept that these people have lived their life, you know, they don't care about your opinion or my opinion or anyone's opinion. They're going to do what they're going to do. And if it makes you uncomfortable, that's too fucking bad.
Leave Tony Montana alone. I don't know. I think he just... Because the Oscars, you're meeting your friends, a couple drinks, you have to go. Even if you're presenting, it's all... Like, I get it. I don't think it's as... Watching it, it wasn't as bad as some people on the internet are making it out to be. But last but not least, what do you think of Ryan Gosling's performance? Just performing I'm Just Ken.
You know what? That's a great, great performance. Excellent. And, you know, excellent example of why that song should have won Song of the Year. I mean, I don't think any song defined the movie more than I'm Just Ken defined Barbie. And
besides Peaches from the Mario Brothers movie, which all
that was also wonderful. But listen, the choreography, dancing, the acting, the humor, it was a catchy song. It like hit the top of the chart. You know, the Oscars sometimes have to get out of their own way, right? We don't all want like.
Oh man, do you want to go into it now?
Well, I guess we're supposed to. So like, that's pretty much where we are, right?
It's like, do you think so? Being said, okay, you would agree this last Oscars 2024 was a great broadcast.
It was a Jimmy fun Kimmel broadcast.
Stop hosting. You're not. That's no. But besides that, like, you think it was still a pretty good overall.
Listen, the problem. Or they still you know, relevant? There's a lot of takes. We're gonna join in on the Oscar discourse. Obviously, it's a little bit cliche at this point to be worried about.
It's not. We're not joining in the discourse, Juan. We're saving Hollywood. That's what we're doing, dude.
We're saving Hollywood. Pay attention, execs. This is where you're gonna get your good ideas from.
Yeah, man.
Now listen. The Oscars are an interesting institution because their relevancy, honestly, I don't think the relevancy can be questioned even today. You know, look at us, look at how many websites and pages and on Twitter and Reddit and all over the internet, people care about who won the Oscars. The nominees always get a big boost to their viewership every year, particularly the actual winners. It is a defining way for us to tell, you know, what the best quality films of the year were.
Oh, it's a way for us to, like, in order to gauge and, like, show it, showcase, hey, here's what we think are the best films of the year.
Yes, yes. Okay. And I think that is a topic that matters a lot to people. Everybody loves rankings. Everybody loves saying what their best movies
are. It's human nature, yeah.
Part of the problem that the Oscars face nowadays is that, one, films themselves aren't as relevant and as central to the entertainment landscape as they used to be.
I heard you say that, but I guess go off on that some more. What do you mean by that exactly?
Look, 20 years ago, let's say when Return of the King and the Lord of the Rings movies were coming out and sweeping all the Oscars, right? You know, at that point, the biggest narrative art pieces, entertainment art pieces, basically 100% were movies. You know, you look at all the biggest artists, you look at all the biggest actors, all the best writers, all the best work was being put into films, right? Okay. You had TV, but TV was Seinfeld and Friends and Frasier and MASH and these kinds of shows. Just fun sitcoms, or, you know, shows like Law and Order and things like that. You know, we show the episode of the week type shows using the same sets pretty much every week. Multicam sitcoms where it's really low production cost, where you can pretty much skip around in any order. There's not much narrative being made. There's not that to say that there wasn't any art or that there wasn't any quality, but TV just was not the central filmmaking.
Okay, I see it. So essentially, if you wanted to go get like the premium experience, that was the theaters.
Yes,
but like because you have to go pay money and all that. But back when we were all at home on and watching cable, like that's kind of like TV, which was, you know, not as premium, basically.
Basically, and I mean, it's difficult, honestly, to even
think I kind of see where you're going, though. Yeah,
you know, for some of the younger folks, you know, TV was just okay. I have to go watch at a specific time of the week if I want to watch my episode, right? I don't get a ticket to whatever time is convenient for me. I have to be show up at 7 p.m. on Thursday.
Or TGIF Fridays, like at this time.
You know, there's no TiVo or anything like that. There's no streaming services. At best, if you didn't catch it, you might get a rerun or it might get syndicated and you might watch things later on. Like, you know, something like Fresh Prince, Friends, Seinfeld. Frankly, until streaming services came out, I had never watched anything close to proper sequential order.
So those are like what you would call true appointment television. Like, hey, at I 7 p.m. you come and you're going to and be here to watch
everything
XYZ.
Was kind of appointment. But the point, my bigger point is that, you know, video games, films, even podcasts like we're doing now, all these kinds of forms of entertainment, they didn't really exist to challenge movies in the same way. They were there, but you know, when you were discussing, okay, what was the best thing? What was the best thing put to film this year? The only thing being discussed was movies, right? If you ask what was the greatest pop narrative created this year, you're gonna go look for a movie, maybe a book, right? You know, people like Harry Potter and stuff. But for the most part, you want the best narrative experience, the best artistic experience. You're going to the movies. Nowadays, you know, you got Game of Thrones, you got Last of Us.
You have streaming, what you're saying. There's other ways.
Not just streaming. I mean, because it started even before streaming with Breaking Bad, with HBO, with The Sopranos. You know, that's when television started becoming prestigious in its own way.
I think I know what you're saying, actually, now listening to you. Because before, you would need to go to a movie to see a two and a half hour long thing or form of entertainment. That was the standard. But now we're getting stuff like TV shows where a long form formatting is we're able to tell stories in a longer format, which are able to come back and garner more viewers, churn an audience up, more so than any movie can ever do. Because you're coming back week by week to watch Breaking Bad.
It's different art styles and they have different values. But you know, now you have those high quality people, you know, you have elite directors, elite actors, elite budgets getting thrown at TV shows.
Yeah, like back in the day, it was obscene for a film person who you go to see in the movie theaters to go back home and watch on TV. They'll be like, hey, what's wrong with you? But now it's kind of flipped. Now you're getting film quality, but on like HBO, like with Game of Thrones or Last of Us and whatnot.
Yeah, basically. Again, video games are a great example of where before, you know, you had these basic Mario games that you beat in 10 hours. Nowadays, you got something like The Last of Us. You got something like The Last of Us. You got Red Dead Redemption.
You got
God of War. They're telling these creative, complete narrative experiences with high production value, sometimes, you know, very high level actors coming in and providing voices or even providing their own likeness to the game. Something like Death Stranding, right? Where Norman Reedus was in it. Kojima. Again, it's the kind of budget and the kind of prestige and the kind of effort that used to be reserved only for movies, right? So when you're asking, okay, why are the Oscars don't have the same place they did 20 years ago? Part of it is at least that movies don't have the same place as they did.
Because you can get that same entertainment in your phone or at home.
That same level of entertainment in different ways. It doesn't have to just be a movie. The movie is no longer the primal, central...
The medium you have to enjoy this stuff on.
Entertainment.
Okay.
And then another problem the Oscars show itself. Because, you know, again, we're discussing, we still find it relevant, but we're mostly discussing the winners and losers, right? You can just look that up the next day on Google.
Yeah.
Right? The value of the show itself isn't, okay, seeing the Hollywood actors, seeing their acceptance speeches. You might get to see a funny moment like John Cena naked or Will Smith slapping the crap out of Chris Rock. But okay, I can just see that on YouTube the next day.
Right.
Right? There's nothing...
What makes the ceremony special?
Yeah. There's nothing for me, the main interest is, okay, I want to know who the awards are. I'll liken it to... An analogy I use is the MVP award or All-Star awards in sports.
Okay.
I care deeply about who the MVP of the NBA season is going to be.
Right.
And who the All-NBA players are going to be and Defensive Player of the Year and all that. Uh-huh. Right. But I'm not going to go watch a 2-hour broadcast.
Okay, yeah.
That's telling me. I just gonna go read on ESPN the next day who the winners are, and then go discuss and talk about that. I care about it a lot, but not enough to go. I just want to know the results. I don't want to know. I don't need to see the gala and the glamour. That doesn't do it for me.
And I'll say this. I guess try to close out this before we get too much into it. But in the Oscars' defense, though, they've made it into like the spectacle that it is. Like we've all kind of understood that, okay, here's the night that we, you know, honor these movies. I think what they can do to be more relevant is just, you know, listen to the viewers and be like, okay, either, cause a lot of things was they used to be like 3 hours long. Now they're shorting it. Now they're listening to just suggestions from the audience and teleplays and all that. So I think they can do that to make more relevant.
That's when you get between a rock and a hard place. If you're at the Oscars, cause look, if you've dropped off of watching the Oscars, you know, having it be 30, 40 minutes shorter probably isn't going to be the thing that gets you back on. On the other hand, you know, you have your core viewers who have been watching every year for 20 years, and they love the 3-hour broadcast.
They'll be there regardless.
And they want, you know, it's an event for them, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so you want to be real careful about alienating these viewers and alienating the people who have stuck with you through thin or thin, who, you know, an Oscar broadcast is a big event that they're going, that's their Super Bowl. They're going to watch that, and they're going to care about how people were dressed, and they're going to go discuss it on Twitter and Reddit and everywhere else. So, you know, it's tricky trying to chase new fans that probably won't come back. And then you possibly alienate the loyal fans who have stuck with you for 20 years. It's a tricky balance. There's also honestly a question of how much of the Oscars' relevance is due to that prestige and that show and that big blowout. You know, nobody really watches the Grammys. I mean, some people do, right? The Grammys have some viewership, the Emmys, these different shows, but they're not trying to capture the same central place in the American entertainment landscape and in the American mind that the Oscars have, right?
And
we don't discuss. Oh, what happened to the Emmys? Like, if they drop off in viewership, it's like, okay, I mean,
no one was watching them.
I just want to know who the winners are. I don't really care who, like, about the show. The Oscars were different because they were supposed to be this big mass appeal event. And once upon a time, you know, one of the things, honestly, that happened is that, frankly, is that 20 years ago, if you wanted to discuss the Oscars intelligently the next day, you had to watch the whole broadcast.
Yeah, you didn't have like a YouTube clip of showing you like the highlights. Yeah, you had to be there.
Like the John Cena naked. If you didn't see John Cena being naked, that was You'd be here. You just weren't going to see it. You showed up to work the next day or school the next day to discuss it. You were going to be the ignorant one. The internet was kind of around, but not at the point where you could just look up live reactions at 10 p.m. on a Sunday. None of this stuff existed.
Yeah, and I honestly hearing you just talk about it, I think it's more so it's a commentary on how we consume media has changed. Also, the way we consume it has caused them to change how media is made, from the whole binging model on Netflix, again, to long story formatting, as opposed to, like, you know, 2-hour traditional the movie theater experience. But I still say this, though, to me, nothing really can replace the movie going experience, being an audience, big screen and all that. But the attempts to replicate that and to have that be more streamlined, I'm not mad at that. And I think that's something that we can definitely discuss.
You know, that could be an interesting idea for some Hollywood exec. Like maybe the Oscars need to be played in movie theaters.
Who knows? Like, who knows?
The communal experience is part of what makes these things great. So, yeah, it could be a fun idea.
No, but I like that. Hey, man, that's a really good discussion. Hold on that. I think we can definitely come back to that. But just to wrap up, we have a segment every week that's going to be called Plug of the Week, where we're going to either talk about or plug a show or a game or comment that we're into that this week. So real quick, Juan, rapid fire, because we have not much time left. What's one thing this week that you're really into, whether it be a game or comic or a TV show or whatever?
So my plug of the week for this week, I've been watching the show Blue White Samurai.
Ooh,
it's in the animation style of Claws and some other Netflix shows.
Yeah, I've seen episode one. It's great. Yeah,
it's kind of meant to be like an Americanized anime. You know, all the characters speak English and stuff. It's a lot of fun. The animation is great. Very violent, as a warning. Very gory. So if you get squeamish, definitely something to look out for. Even though it's animated, trust me, you will get a little squeamish.
Okay, yeah. I've enjoyed it. I haven't seen a lot of it. I've only seen one episode, but no, that's a really cool one.
What about you, Kosi? What's your...
Dude, Shogun. It was a show back in the 70s, I believe, way before my time. But it's a show that's now out right now. Hiroki Sanada is in it. It's incredible cast, incredible cinematography, incredible acting. Just, it's feudal Japan. If you haven't played Ghost of Tsushima, it's like that. But like in real life, it's amazing. I can't stress it enough. It's awesome.
But yeah. And just that show is on FX.
Yes, it's on Hulu, and I believe
it's made by FX.
But you can catch it on Hulu, and Blue Eyed Samurai you can find on Netflix.
That's right.
All right, Juan. Well, that's good stuff, dude. But so once again, guys, this is the It Was Mooney podcast, and I am Kosi, always joined by
Juan E.B.
And adios, guys. See y'all next time.